This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I Aim at the Stars was a 1960 film about Dr. Wernher von Braun, a former member of the Nazi Party, who would make NASA's dream of putting a man on the moon possible. Well, NASA now actually is aiming at a star, our star, the sun. This summer, they'll be launching a spacecraft towards the sun to conduct tests in its atmosphere, something they've never done before because, as Icarus found out, it gets a little hot out there. Here to tell us more about NASA's moment in the sun, as well as other short subjects in science, is Sarah Kaplan, science writer for The Washington Post. Sarah, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, good to be here.
So NASA gets to check mission to the sun off its bucket list soon, is that right?
Yeah, this is actually something the agency has wanted to do since the 50s, like basically since it was founded. And it wasn't possible because, as you mentioned, it gets really hot up there. But now, because of advances in science and also advances in technology, they finally managed to build a spacecraft that's capable of withstanding this really intense heat. So we're headed this summer.
Did you actually get to see the shield on the spacecraft?
Yeah, so the spacecraft is right now being tested and put together at Goddard Space Flight Center. And I got to go into the clean room where they're kind of putting it all together right before it went into a thermal testing chamber. So it's this like big empty warehouse space, and you have to be really careful when you go in that you don't accidentally contaminate the spacecraft.
So you didn't contaminate it at all?
This is where I confess that I actually sneezed while I was in the clean room. So hopefully, I sneezed away from the spacecraft. Hopefully, none of my mucus is going to cause a problem for this mission that's 60 years in the making.
I think the solar radiation will kind of sterilize all that away.
Yeah, hopefully.
Tell us what kind of tests they're going to be doing in the sun's atmosphere.
So there's even though the sun is sort of right there, it's this like huge thing in our sky, it's actually a pretty mysterious place. And there are two kind of big questions that NASA wants to answer. The first is something that called the solar wind, which is the stream of charged particles that goes at supersonic speed, so faster than the speed of sound, comes sort of blasting out of the sun, and it goes all the way to the edge of our solar system. And we don't really understand kind of how it gets sped up so fast or where it's coming from. So that's one question that they're trying to answer. And then the other is the atmosphere of the sun is actually hotter than the surface of the sun by about 300 times hotter, wow. Which is like if you went up into the stratosphere and you were suddenly boiling. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And so that's another, like, really big mystery that NASA's going to be trying to solve.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting. All right, up next, scientists have discovered, there's news this week, the oldest human remains outside of Africa. And there were tools nearby. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is this jawbone from a human, Homo sapiens, that was discovered in this cave in Israel. And most human, the earliest known human remains before this were about 100,000, maybe 120,000 years old outside Africa, which is where our species originated. But these ones are 177 to as old as 194,000 years old, so like 50,000 years older. And it's a big surprise because we just didn't think that Homo sapiens was so adventurous that early in our history. And they've also got these cool tools nearby that are, they're a very special processing technique called Levallois, which means that you kind of have to, like, it's kind of like the way a sculptor sees the sculpture inside a stone before he starts carving. You have to be able to see the point that you want to make in a, like, given piece of rock before you start sort of chipping it away to make the tool that you want. And that requires, you know, sophisticated intellect because you have to be able to see into the future. So that indicates that these guys were, you know, pretty smart.
Wow. But does it mean we're pushing back the timeline for when humans migrated out of Africa?
Not necessarily. I mean, it means that we're adventuring out of Africa earlier, but that those adventures might not have lasted very long. If you look at the DNA of modern people from Asia and Europe and the Americas, our genetics trace back to about 60 to 70,000 years ago. And so that was kind of the final migration that allowed humans to push out of Africa and colonize the world. So most of our sort of evolution and development probably still happened in the African continent.
Yeah. Let's move on to our next story because it's hard to believe. It's been two decades since Dolly the sheep, but now Chinese researchers have cloned a pair of macaque monkeys.
Mm-hmm. So instead of Dolly the sheep, you've got Zong Zong and Hua Hua, two cute little monkeys that were cloned using this new technique, or it's the same technique as Dolly the sheep, where you take a nucleus from the individual you want to clone, and that has all of its genetic material in it, and then you plug it into an egg cell, right. And that will develop into an embryo.
I remember when we covered Dolly the sheep on Science Friday, it was such, wow, cutting-edge news. Now it's sort of like ho-hum. They did a couple of, macaques. What else are they going to do tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, we've done it for a few species, and actually this technique has been used just for medical research on some human cells. So it is kind of, people have been working on it for a while. And the only reason it took so long with these monkeys is that there's a lot of sort of epigenetic factors in development that you have to consider. So for each individual species, you have to know exactly the right treatment for the embryo to get it to develop into a little tiny monkey.
And no one is saying this is leading to human cloning at this point.
No. It's the objective for this is more for medical research and basic research. We are a long way off, if ever, from human clones.
Well, we'll have to keep checking in about the health of those two, because it's a long run to see, how well they actually do.
But Dolly wasn't too bad, so hopefully they will fare well, too.
Yeah. And finally, it's a new year, which means the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has moved the doomsday clock closer to midnight.
Yeah, so the every
not a
year
good thing,
they
is it?
No, if you needed some existential dread going into the weekend, here it is, because of sort of developments in nuclear weapons and also humanity's sort of continued inaction on climate change. The bulletin has decided that we are now 30 seconds closer to midnight than we were last year, and this is actually the closest we've ever been since the height of the Cold War, and since 1953. So the situation is pretty dire.
I'm pulling out my Fallout Shelter manual and my duck and cover old videos.
Yeah, stock up on canned goods.
Sarah Kaplan, science writer for The Washington Post, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. And now it's time for the State of Science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Focusing on a science story near you. And when you think of offshore wind energy, what do you picture? The ocean, right? A small wind farm maybe off of Rhode Island, large wind farms off of Norway and Denmark. But what about Lake Erie? Plenty of wind there, no doubt. And my next guest has been reporting on the progress of a project that, when completed, would be the first offshore wind facility on the Great Lakes. Andy Belaskowitz is a contributor to NC Magazine and reporter for Midwest Energy News. He joins us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So how big is this wind project?
So, relatively small. First thing to remember about this, it's called the Icebreaker Project. It's six turbines, about 21 megawatts, which the developers say is enough to power about 7,000 homes.
7,000 homes. And what kind of potential do the Great Lakes as a whole have for wind energy?
So researchers for the past several years have been looking at the Great Lakes potential, finding out some of the best areas for doing it, and it turns out there's a relatively good supply or good areas where it could be done. So Lake Erie is one of them. Mm-hmm. Lake Michigan, sort of in the middle of the Lower Peninsula, as well as Lake Huron, sort of on the thumb of Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. They've also found some good areas up in Lake Superior, but some other challenges there in terms of water depth and just sort of the more rugged conditions make that a little more challenging.
So which city on Lake Erie is going to be closest to it?
City of Cleveland. It'll be about 8 miles or so out from Cleveland. So standing on the shore, you could sort of make out.
And tell me why this is the first one. Why is it taken so long here?
So the history of this is pretty interesting in the Great Lakes. From what I understand, the first ideas of a project outside of Cleveland originated around 2004, 2005 by some local groups and foundations who really saw it as an economic development opportunity, and some of the challenges that city and others in the Midwest have had economically. It was seen early on as a way to sort of be a leader on this issue and with this technology. And then by about 2008, 2009 was really the height of interest. You saw most of the states that are along the Great Lakes involved in this in some way or another. Michigan, the administration under former Governor Jennifer Granholm was very active in this space, and the idea was to sort of get a policy in place that could perhaps be modeled by other states and move forward that way. However, a couple of factors, one being the 2010 election is often brought up, that sort of wave Republican election we saw in the Midwest really changed in Michigan, for example, brought in a new administration where it really wasn't a priority. At this time, several states had adopted what are renewable portfolio standards, which are basically goals down the line where you have to get a certain amount of renewable energy as part of your portfolio. The cost of onshore wind came down pretty quickly, and so that kind of became the main way to meet these goals rather than offshore wind. And so by about 2012, 2013, other states had lost interest as well, and Icebreaker just seems to be the only project that's sort of continued to chug along.
Mm-hmm. So we can, if this is, everybody will be watching this one, right? If this works, maybe more are popping up.
Absolutely. I've heard, that developers in other states are interested. Certainly, even the province of Ontario, the government there is looking at this because they put a moratorium in place in 2011 to basically study the issue more after they had already moved forward with some leasing. There was some controversy surrounding that, but officials there are saying, you know, we want to see what happens in Ohio.
Right.
And a key piece of this is, and what's sort of been holding this up a little bit is working through all the different permitting processes.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to go, Andy. But thank you very much for the heads up. Andy Belaskowitz is contributor to NC Magazine, reporter for Midwest Energy News. We'll be back right after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ever argue with family members about climate change or GMOs or whether they should get a flu shot? Someone who you think doesn't have the science quite right when they formed their opinions? Well, we at Science Friday, we want to help you. We're taking this hour and talking about it, how, if not change someone's mind, to at least consider the evidence when forming an opinion. And we're rolling out a set of social media shareable fact cards. You can whip out these flashcards when you want to remind your friend of the evidence, so to speak, that global warming is not a hoax created by the Chinese. Let me introduce my first guest, Emily Shepard, recent graduate of the Missouri School of Journalism's Donald J. Reynolds Journalism Institute. She was part of a special team that helped us build the new Science Facts resource, and you can check out some of those resources, which we're rolling out over the next few weeks, on our website at sciencefriday.com/sciencefacts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, tell us about this. How did this all get started?
Well, Science of Facts is about putting the facts first on these controversial topics like vaccines, GMOs, climate change, just to encourage our audience members to have conversations with their friends and family about those topics. So we've curated some key facts on these complex issues, and we've turned that into information into visual, shareable elements for social media to help facilitate those conversations.
Mm-hmm. And how hard is it to convince people?
See, you know, we're really not necessarily taking the approach of trying to convince people. Our goal is really to present the facts first and kind of let them speak for themselves. The data really does show, you know, all of these recent revelations that, you know, we've had in the scientific community. And recently, you know, GMOs, vaccines, climate change, they've been recently politicized, but you know, we're talking about facts here. You know, it's not necessarily, you know, something that needs to be debated, but we want to give people the stepping stones to have these conversations and draw their own conclusions.
And what are some of the facts that the team chose to highlight?
Well, we've actually had some really great content produced on Science Friday shows, so we pulled a lot of our content from there. For example, the current campaign that we're working on, vaccines, we had a quote from Dr. Paul Offit talking about the different components of vaccines. So we really want to highlight these key facts that really help demonstrate the relevance of these issues and how to talk about them with people who, you know, may not have that information at their fingertips or don't understand the topics overall.
How can having better facts change the conversations we have about frustrating subjects like climate change?
You know, it's really important that we have really clear and concise information, right? And so at the Missouri School of Journalism, we really do focus on putting the factual information first. And my specialization is putting those facts in a format that, you know, can be applied to social media and you know, emerging forms of media, because that social media is the place where people are having these conversations. And we want to be able to give people information so that they can share it and talk about it and give, you know, people talking points.
Mm-hmm. Well, why not teach people to argue more persuasively with people who don't believe that climate change is happening? You know, I want to prove people wrong about this, you know?
Right. You know, and Science Friday has worked with that before. It was actually a really popular How to Talk with a Climate Change Denier was one of our featured articles that we had. And that, you know, that's a component that, you know, Science Friday has recognized as well. But we found that, you know, in communicating with people who are non-believers, right, you just want to, you have to give them a morsel of information to really grasp onto, because, you know, you can't argue with the facts, really. You know, the studies show, data is very, very clear. So yeah, we really are trying to emphasize these, you know, fact-based conversations.
I always try to emphasize the evidence more than the facts, because, you know, everybody can have their own fact, but they can't have their own evidence.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And for example, in our fact cards, we do highlight all of the, you know, important data that helps demonstrate, you know, the relevance and the relevance of these issues.
Well, thank you, Emily. Emily Shepherd, recent graduate of the Missouri School of Journalism. She helped Science Friday make its new shareable fact resources. And you can see these shareable facts at sciencefriday.com/sciencefacts. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you so much.
And in case you just joined us, we're talking about how to have a civil conversation with people who are skeptical about science. We've talked about discussing climate change and GMOs on this program, but how about vaccination? Coincidentally, do you know that today marks the 195th anniversary of the death of Edward Jenner, the physician who brought us the smallpox vaccine? And here we are 200 years later, when many parents are hesitant about the safety of immunizations or dubious about the necessity of getting their kids immunized. Only about 40% of U.S. population, 40% of the population, had received a flu vaccination by November this season. Is there a way to convince people they should still get their kids or themselves vaccinated, especially in this brutal flu season? Let me introduce my next guest. Gretchen Chapman is a professor in the Department of Social and Design Sciences at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday. And also with me is Amanda Dempsey, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Colorado in Denver. Welcome, Amanda.
Thanks, Ira.
Well, how big is the problem of people saying no to vaccines?
Well, it's a growing problem. We know from national studies that in the past there have been about maybe 10 to 15% of parents who had concerns about vaccines such that they might not get one or more of the vaccines that were recommended for their children. And over the last decade or two, that number has grown to be more like 25 to 35% who are refusing at least one vaccine for their child. That said, though, there's a pretty stable population of the percent of people who refuse all vaccines. For the last couple decades, that's remained steady at about 1 to 2%.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the biggest reasons that people tend not to get vaccinated?
Well, there's been a lot of research about that. Some of it has come from our own work here at the UC School of Medicine in Denver. And When you look at the reasons people give for not getting vaccines, they really fall into three main categories. The first one is that they often have concerns about the safety of the vaccine. Now, whether or not those concerns are valid is a debatable point, but that's one of the reasons that they give. The second is that a lot of people aren't convinced that vaccines are actually necessary, and part of this is because vaccines have been so successful in really reducing the diseases that they prevent that a lot of people haven't had firsthand experience with, a vaccine-preventable disease that used to be really common. And then the third major issue has to do with access. So people might be interested or generally accepting of vaccines, but it doesn't take priority over other things that they might have to do in their lives that take up time as well. And so they for whatever reason, just can't get into a clinic or a doctor's office to get them.
There are people who sort of are on the cusp of these issues. I have a tweet from the Mode Fanatic who says, while the actual vaccines are technically safe, I do believe the manner, meaning four in one, bundled and kids at a certain age does have an effect on kids. Maybe people want to spread them out a little more? Have you heard that reasoning?
Yes, definitely. I'm a pediatrician, so this comes up a lot in my own clinical practice, and that is a concern that people have. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that actually the vaccines that people who are now the age of parents might have gotten when they were children were actually manufactured in such a way that they were getting way more antigens in those vaccines 20, 30 years ago. So even though there's an increased number of vaccines, meaning more shots going into arms in this day and age, they're produced in such a way that the number of antigens that are being introduced is actually less than what we got before.
Gretchen Chapman, when doctors encounter a parent who is worried that a vaccine is unsafe for their child, what's the best way to handle it? Should they just try to tell them they're wrong?
Well, we know that physician recommendations are one of the strongest predictors of vaccination behavior. So just simply a physician recommending the vaccine is very powerful. We also know that the way that physicians recommend vaccinations are important. So a recent study shows that presumptive recommendations, so if you say, your child is due for the HPV vaccination this visit, so we'll be giving it at the end of the visit. That's a presumptive vaccination that just sort of assumes we're going to do it. That's much more effective than if it's a discussive recommendation where you say, like, let's discuss whether or not you'd like to have the HPV vaccination. And so it sort of creates the attitude that, of course, we're going to do this. And then the parent has to jump in and say, wait, I'm not sure I want to do this if they don't want to do it.
So you're sort of validating their fears but telling them how to get around those fears.
Yeah, and you're communicating that this is the norm, this is what most people do, this is what I strongly recommend.
Yeah. Amanda, your research is looking at a tool for physicians to help them have better conversation with hesitant parents. So what would this look like?
Yeah, so we actually did a trial here where we introduced a physician communication toolkit, and the focus was specifically on HPV vaccines, but you could really apply the lessons learned to any vaccine conversation. And we taught providers the presumptive recommendation, like Gretchen just mentioned, and then we also taught them an additional skill called motivational interviewing, which is something that's been around for a long time but hasn't really been applied to the field of vaccinations. And what motivational interviewing is basically a way of framing a conversation. It's a communication technique where you try to actively reduce people's barriers to hearing information that might be slightly different than what they think their beliefs are, and try to use people's own inherent motivation for making health behavior decisions. Mm-hmm. So we were able to teach providers how to use some of the skills in motivational interviewing to have more effective conversations about the HPV vaccine and actually increase their HPV vaccination rates for their patients.
Our number 844-724-8255, in case you just joined us. We're talking about talking with your friends about science issues, and we're focusing on vaccinations. A couple of interesting tweets came through here. Darren Sober says, the medical industry lacks credibility because of profit motives. Liz says, we have blood drives. Can we have flu shot drives? I got my flu shot 2 weeks ago. Would have gotten it sooner if it had leapt out in front of me.
Yeah, Gretchen has some really interesting research on sort of feasibility and making vaccines easier that support that tweet from the second person.
Do you, Gretchen?
Yeah, absolutely. Making vaccines the easy action to take is a very effective way to foster vaccination rates, especially among people who are generally positive about vaccinations, but maybe it's just not their top priority. They're busy. So one of my studies manipulated whether or not vaccine appointments were the default or not. The default is the thing that you get if you don't take any direct action. So some patients got a letter saying you can make a vaccine appointment if you want one, and other patients got a letter saying we've pre-scheduled you for an appointment and you can cancel it if you don't want it. And more people in that second group got vaccinated.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. A few years ago, you might have referenced this, we had Paul Offit on to talk about vaccine research. And we had a caller named Chantal who spent 8 minutes on the air. I gave her all the time she wanted, explaining how no amount of evidence would ever convince her that vaccines were safe, especially because her government was involved in the research. She said, I remember correctly, I gave her a long time to, you know, I wanted to hear what she had to say. She said, I basically don't trust anything my government tells me. Is that commonly heard, or is that, you know, something you're never going to overcome?
Trust in the vaccination system, including trust in the government that orchestrates it, is one of the main components of vaccine confidence. So that's an important part that we have to foster when we want people to get vaccinated. It's rare for someone to have that adamant of a view, but certainly it happens. And I think an interesting question is, where should we be putting our priorities in trying to foster increased vaccination? Should we be trying to convince the people who have very strident views like that, or should we be focusing our energies on people who are busy and distracted with other things and would get vaccinated if it was more convenient for them, but don't have strident anti-vaccination views.
Does it help, Gretchen, to talk about the worst-case scenarios of not getting vaccinated? For example, more than 30 kids have died this flu season already. Does this sway the hesitant at all?
Well, I do think that that's an important technique that vaccine advocates should use. That's sort of taking a page from the book from the anti-vaccination advocates, who often use very salient personal stories that are easily remembered and have a high emotional content. And I think that the people supporting vaccination can do the same thing. And unfortunately, we do have people dying from vaccine-preventable diseases. And those make very tear-jerker stories, which, you know, we could be preventing if more people got vaccinated. So let's tell those stories and hopefully convince some more people.
Let me go to Rita before we go to the break. Go to Rita in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rita.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, my question or my comment has to do with the training of physicians to just consider some vaccinations just to be a matter of course and not allow the parent to consider that it might be something they don't want. And I feel like by doing that, it disrespects the parents. I feel like the physicians should be educators too, and that parents should be fully informed.
Yeah, so I agree with that viewpoint. I mean, parents are the ultimate decision makers for what their children get. But the reality is that there are very strong and clear recommendations that all children should get vaccinated, and it is considered the norm. So if you as a parent decide not to do that, then that's going against what is every medical organization says is the right thing to do. So what we try to train providers to do is to just reiterate that message that, you know, this is considered the standard of care. And, you know, of course, as a parent, you have the ultimate decision-making power of what goes into your children's body. And I think all providers are prepared to answer parents' questions about vaccines. So we certainly would never advocate that, you know, people withhold information. But for a lot of parents, they don't actually have that degree of concern. And so just hearing a strong, clear recommendation from their provider is enough to make them feel confident about getting the vaccines and to allay any minor concerns that they have. And so what we try to do in our trial is to start the conversation that way, but then to have providers quickly recognize if a parent does have more questions or has concerns that they want to talk about, that they have the skills and the tools to be able to address those concerns as much as the parent needs them to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. I wish we had more time to talk with Rita. We have to go to the break. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more about vaccinations, and all global warming, things like that, how to talk to your friends and relatives about these sticky subjects. We'll be right back after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how physicians can help convince more patients to vaccinate their kids or vaccinate themselves, saying this as the flu is really bad this year, but also because the U.S. continues to experience the occasional measles epidemic, whooping cough outbreak, and more. Our number, 844-724-8255. Lots of tweets coming in. Let me just read a few of them. Diane Port says, I'm 65. I have two doctors who will not administer the shingles shot. They claim they have seen patients have heart attacks. How would you address this? Other listeners want you to address how vaccines are linked to autism. Is there any evidence for that? Someone else says, we need to stop advertising any drugs and shots on TV. Big Pharma rules on all fronts. We also have some phone calls coming in. Let me go right to the phones. Let's go to Ken in St. Louis. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I really want to thank you for doing this topic. I'm a pediatrician at St. Louis University and Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital, and I do all the things that we talk about here. One thing I would like to add, though, is that it is key for me to address the fears of patients and take them seriously. It can be really frustrating to, you know, hear a patient say things that I know are wrong, and I have to remember this is about the patient. And so I'll start with, you know, the fact that you have fear about your child's safety is normal and natural and healthy, and it shows me how much you love your child. When I do that, they see that I see them, I take them seriously, and then we can have a conversation.
Okay. Thanks for calling. Good rules that this doctor's following? My guests, Gretchen Chapman, Amanda Dempsey?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, belief that vaccines are safe is part of vaccine confidence, and by and large, vaccines are very safe. For example, the belief that the MMR vaccine causes autism does not have any scientific evidence behind it. In fact, there's lots of scientific evidence refuting that association. Unfortunately, autism is just a quite prevalent diagnosis. More than 1% of children in the U.S. are diagnosed with autism, and often the first signs come around the same time that kids are getting the MMR vaccine. So there's just a coincidental confluence of getting that vaccine and then noticing signs of autism, which causes people to think that there's an association.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think what that doctor did is really a key example of how we use motivational interviewing to help with this problem. He really keyed in on a motivating factor for that parent, which is, you know, being concerned about their child's health and doing what they think is in their best interest. And so there are ways to use leverage points like that mm-hmm. to get parents to see vaccines maybe from a slightly different angle in a way that they hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, we've been talking about how the healthcare system can better encourage people to get vaccinations, but is there a role for the rest of us, for the media, or, you know, for we all are in this together?
I think it's really important to realize that the number of people that are really completely against vaccines is very small, and the number of people that are for vaccines is actually the majority of the population. And then there's a pretty good sized group that are basically in support of vaccines but maybe have some pretty serious questions or concerns about them. And I think what ends up happening in the media a lot is that the newsworthy stories are the stories about the people who are strongly against vaccines and maybe talking about these emotional stories. And so it appears to the general public that maybe this is way more common than it actually is. We don't hear a lot of stories about people who are supportive of vaccines, got their children vaccinated, and were happy to do so. And I think it tends to undermine the message about how normative that behavior actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And vaccine success stories, by definition, just aren't much of a story. If vaccination goes as planned, the person gets vaccinated, there's no side effects, and they don't get sick. So absolutely nothing happens. It's a really boring story, but that's what we want.
Yeah. And we also don't see, you know, people in with polio lying flat for the rest of their lives inside a machine either.
That's right. Yeah.
We don't see these infectious diseases that used to be quite prevalent because guess what? Vaccination works.
I think that's where we're going to leave it. I want to thank my guests, Amanda Dempsey, Associate Professor of Pediatrics, University of Colorado in Denver, Gretchen Chapman, Professor of Social and Decision Sciences at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Thank you. Thank you both, doctors, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Next up, with the flu season, as we keep saying, it's in full swing. Now comes word it's just not sniffles and fevers and aches and pains we need to worry about. A new study out this week in the New England Journal of Medicine suggests that your risk of heart attack can be up to 6 times higher when you have the flu, especially if you're an older person. And it's not just the flu virus that boosts that risk. Dr. Kevin Schwartz is one of the authors of that study and an infectious disease physician at Public Health Ontario in Toronto. He joins us from the CBC there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Schwartz.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your study. How did you come to the conclusion that the flu might boost the risk of heart attack?
Sure. So what we did in this study is we looked at a cohort of patients with laboratory-confirmed influenza, and we then looked at the risk of heart attacks within 7 days of influenza infection compared to other periods of time that would be 1 year before or 1 year after the influenza infection. And what we found was, as you mentioned, that six-fold increased risk within that one-week risk period after influenza infection compared to those control time periods.
And did you test for other viruses too, like cold viruses, stuff like that, that might have an effect on the risk of heart attack?
Absolutely, yeah. So we did that, and that was a little bit surprising. We didn't expect to find differences for all the other viruses. We were able, with our sample size, to look at RSV, or respiratory syncytial virus, and we found a significant association. Although it was lower than influenza, it was 3.5 was the increased risk. We looked at all other viruses that were not influenza and not RSV, and again, we found a significant association that was 2.7. Roughly increased risk during that risk interval. We've also looked at negative swabs, so nasal swabs tested for viruses that we did not detect any, and that's probably a mix of different conditions, either viruses that weren't tested for, or perhaps bacterial pneumonias and other infectious conditions. And we also did see a significant risk, although a smaller one, for that group as well.
So how would a viral infection affect your heart?
Yeah, so good question. I mean, the leading theory is that you get this inflammatory response from influenza. That inflammation in the body changes your platelets, it changes your clotting risk, and it can precipitate clots in the coronary arteries, leading to a heart attack. We know that influenza also increases your metabolic demand. It causes your heart to race, and that stress on the body also probably contributes to somebody who's already at risk of heart attack then developing a heart attack in relation to this stressor.
So what group in the population is at the highest risk?
Yeah, so the population in this study were generally those that were at risk of heart attack. So above the age of 65 were most of them. A lot of people in the study had diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. This study didn't have the sample size to differentiate those different risks, but certainly the risk seemed higher, at least for those older in the study, but we weren't able to tease it out. But certainly those at higher risk of heart attacks are likely to be at higher risk of having one after an influenza infection.
So if it's possibly inflammation, would you taking some of the NSAIDs or the other inflammation dampening drugs be helpful?
Really good question. Yeah. I mean, we honestly don't know the answer to that. There's some data that taking antivirals and anti-inflammatories together when you have an influenza infection may improve the symptoms overall. Now, whether or not they actually would reduce a event like a heart attack afterwards is a really interesting and important question that we don't have an answer to that right now.
Mm-hmm. There was another study out this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that says coughing and sneezing aren't necessary to spread the flu. All you need to do to get the virus is to be around someone who's breathing, who has the virus. It's pretty scary. We all thought you had to be sneezed on.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an interesting study. I mean, we know that influenza is very contagious. So, I mean, that is certainly not new. I think where that study was interesting is that they looked for larger particles. And now for large particles, you need to be close to somebody, right? You need to be within probably 6 feet of them when they're projecting those particles for you to catch the infection. The study showed that even smaller particles of influenza that may float around the air there at further distances are probably present. And what's interesting is it's not just from coughing or sneezing, but they're present from normal breathing. And I'm certainly not surprised by that finding. They did show in that study that if you're coughing, you are going to spread more of the virus, which is going to make it more contagious. But certainly just being near someone who is sick is theoretically possible to catch influenza that way.
Oh, like just being near somebody, not going to do it. How long does the flu virus actually hang out, let's say, on a subway pole or handle of something?
Yeah, it depends on the type of surface, but most of the time it would only be anywhere from a few hours to up to 2 days. And there's some studies showing that you can recover virus from some surfaces 48 hours after it was put there. So it is possible to get it from things like door handles and the subway for up to a couple days.
I've heard that there's something like a 3-foot rule in hospitals. What's that about? Should I start keeping at least 3 feet away from sick people?
Yeah, and that's how, you know, we tend to design where we place beds that are in the emergency room and things like that to try and prevent spread from one patient to another. And so usually most droplet spread, like how influenza and the common cold is typically spread, is going to come out of somebody's mouth with a cough or with breathing, and then it's going to fall usually within a few feet of that person. So, you know, if you're designing a hospital or you want to try and avoid catching these viruses, if you're staying within further than 3 to 6 feet away from somebody, you're certainly going to decrease the risk of it being spread.
You know, it's funny, so we did a video a few months ago about the hospital or ventilation systems. And when a sneeze, it was a video about sneezing, and it showed that when somebody sneezes, all the droplet particles, if it's a typical ventilation system, go up into the ceiling right into the intake of the air system for the hospital or the office, the worst place you could send it. And that's just where they tend to go. So,
yeah, it's very scary. You know, it's like movies like Outbreak that make things perhaps a little more scary than they really are. Most infectious diseases do not spread that way. I mean, there's examples like tuberculosis, measles, and chickenpox, for instance, that are very contagious. They're small droplets, and they spread through the air. So you could be in a totally other part of a room or even in a different room and potentially catch some of those infections. Most things like influenza, common colds are not as contagious. You really need to be in direct contact or within a few feet of somebody to catch those infections.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about the flu with Kevin Schwartz, infectious disease doctor at Public Health Ontario in Toronto. Let me take a call. I have a Ken from South Florida. Hi, Ken. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
It's actually Kia.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So that's okay. So last year, my son was at a friend's house who had the flu, and everywhere I was trying to get him a flu shot, all the pharmacists I spoke with, like CVS and all of them, said that they wouldn't necessarily give him the flu shot because it's not going to do anything for him because he's been already exposed. So this year, I normally, let me preface by saying, I don't get the flu shot. I don't give it to any of my children. We have four. This year, unfortunately, he got the flu. And when we went to the doctor, she said that he had the type of flu that had already mutated. Like, there's no vaccination for it. He's just going to have to sweat it out or wait it out. Mm. The scary part, though, is he's an athlete, and he was having the most scariest heart palpitations, and I had never heard of that before. And then I started trying to research it and called the doctor, and they said, of course, because it affects the muscles and it affects the heart muscles. And so I'm just
curious. You're worried. You're scared. You're worried. Let me see.
Let me see.
We don't like to talk about individual cases, but I'll see if I can get you some free medical help. Kevin Schwartz, what do you think?
Yeah, let me make a couple comments to that. So I just want to stress that we use the term flu very loosely. So often we think when people say flu, we don't necessarily differentiate between influenza infection and other viruses that cause cold and flu-like symptoms. So the influenza vaccine only protects against influenza, and it's actually very difficult to differentiate those different types of viruses without a test in the laboratory.
So.
Yeah, go ahead.
As far as she's concerned, does she have cause for worry about her son?
No, and so what I would say is the influenza vaccine protects against multiple different strains of influenza. So, for instance, like this year, there is a quadrivalent or a influenza vaccine that covers four different strains. Which is recommended for children. And so even if you've had one type of influenza, it's still recommended to get the flu shot because you're going to be protected against those other strains.
So he should get the flu shot, but he's already got some flu and she's concerned about his muscle.
Yeah, so even if you've had flu-like illness or even if you've had laboratory-confirmed influenza infection that year, there's good reason to get the flu shot that year still to protect against those other strains. And we tend to see things like influenza B come later in the year in most years, although this year is the exception to that, is that we're seeing influenza A and B come up simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. And last week, they talked about one universal flu vaccine idea. And this week, there was a study exploring using nanoparticles that was very effective in laboratory animal tests. So I guess they are making some progress in trying to come up with a universal vaccine.
Yeah, this is the holy grail of really influenza vaccine development. It's been very challenging, just because the part of the flu virus which induces that immune response is changing almost year to year, and that immune response is not long lasting. Yeah. So it's a really interesting, I think, technology and approach that those researchers are taking to try and take part of the flu virus that does not mutate and then make it induce an immune response it's going to be long-lasting. Yeah.
Dr. Kevin Schwartz, infectious disease physician at Public Health Ontario in Toronto, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to check out any of the studies we mentioned today, we have them all linked up at sciencefriday.com/flu. One more thing before we go. It's still book club season. We're reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Last week, we talked about modern Frankensteins, and we received this call from Melissa, who taught the book in her English class for high school seniors.
A lot of bioethics came up in conversation, such as cloning, stem cell, and whether that would be a good idea to continue on that path with cloning, because the information gets into the wrong hands. The students felt like you could actually create a monster. The biggest thing that came out of it for my students is that it dispelled the myth. They were proud that they knew the real story.
This week we want you to tell us, was Victor Frankenstein, who impulsively creates a living being then turns his back on it, was Victor a good scientist? Why or why not? Leave us a short voicemail, 567-243-2456. Was he a good scientist? 567-243-2456. That's about all the time we have this week. You can check us out on Amazon Echo, Google Home, everywhere, every day. It's Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What makes a good dance song? Even if you don't know the song, of course, it's Let's Dance by David Bowie. You could recognize it as a dance song, right? Something you get up and gets you up and moving, and you know it's a dance song. But cultures all around the world have their own dance songs. But would you be able to recognize them as you did that David Bowie song? In other words, is there something universally true about music or how our brain recognizes music that connects all these dance-type songs? And are we able to pick up on that? That's exactly the question that my next guests and their team wanted to find out. They took different types of songs from all over the world and played them for people to see what they recognized. People in 60 countries listened to songs from 86 mostly small-scale societies, and their study was published this week in the journal Current Biology. Let me introduce my guests. Excuse me. Samuel Mayer is a research associate in the Department of Psychology and principal investigator of the Music Lab at Harvard University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Amanvir Singh is a PhD candidate in human evolutionary biology, also at Harvard. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thank you. Hello.
Amvar, let me ask you first. In this study, you were interested in seeing if listeners were able to match up the form of a song to its function. Can you explain what you mean and what you were looking for? Why were you interested in this?
Yeah. So what we mean is we were kind of asking, do songs that share social functions around the world, share functions like being used to make people to dance or being used to calm fussy infants, heal illness, do they have convergent features? And we were thinking both about the contextual features, so stuff like whether instruments are used or the gender of the singers, but also, very importantly, the musical features. So the melodic complexity, the rhythmic complexity, the tempo, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And Samuel, for the first part of the study, you used the internet to play clips to people online to see if they could pick out these types of songs, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we had a pretty large collection of songs from all over the world as part of the Natural History of Song Discography, which is a project that Manvir and I co-direct with Luke Glowacki. And we took little snippets of each song, 14 seconds apiece, and played them to listeners in 60 different countries all over the world. And the experiment's really simple. Basically, people all over the world listen to each snippet and then answer a series of questions about each of them about what they think the singers are doing. We asked them, do you think the singers are using the song for dancing? Do you think they're using the song to soothe an infant, to heal illness, and so on.
All right, let's let our listeners in on the fun. We're going to play the songs for them. Let's listen to one form. There are three different dance songs in this one clip. Those were dance samples from the Yanggu of Australia, the Mentawe of Southeast Asia, and the Hopi of Arizona, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And how well were listeners able to identify these as dance songs, Samuel?
Oh, so the really striking finding, especially for dance songs, is that not only are people around the world very accurate at identifying when a song is being used for dancing, they rate it quite highly on this dimension used for dancing, but they're also really confident in their ratings. They rate it, you know, super high on the scale relative to other songs, and they rate them highly consistently with other listeners around the world. So it doesn't matter if I'm sitting here, you know, in Cambridge listening to this dance song, or you know, Manvir's doing it from Mentawai. We agree with each other.
All right, let me listen to another form. I'm going to give out three more songs. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to reveal what type it is. So listeners, try to guess what type of songs these are. Yeah. What do you think? What kind of songs were they? Time's up. I'm going to tell you. They were lullaby samples from the Sami of Scandinavia, the Nyangatam of East Africa, and the Ainu of East Asia. Does identifying the type of song have to do with the elements of the song? You would think that a lullaby would be right quieter, have less singers, Sam or Manvir?
Yeah, so what we actually found in a follow-up experiment was that, yeah, listeners do seem to be using the features of the songs to make their rating decisions. And lullabies in particular are defined, seem to be different on all of the features that we examined. So they have slower tempos, they are less melodically and rhythmically complex, they are less happy sounding, kind of less exciting. And we saw that listeners use both these musical features as well as the contextual features, like is there an instrument or is, you know, the gender of the person singing. So, yeah, it seems like they are using those features.
Mm-hmm. Samuel, you're a cognitive scientist. Do you think that our brains form to pick up these type of songs for some reason?
Well, so I think that's one of the sort of interesting questions that's still open that research like this paper helps us to begin to answer. So theories from biological evolutionary work and cultural evolutionary work make different predictions about what we should find in the world when we study music across different cultures. And those theories are testable in these data sets. So two theories are out there about, you know, where dance music might come from a biological perspective and where lullabies might come from a biological perspective. And both of those make predictions not only that dance songs and lullabies should share features across cultures, which is what we find in this paper, but also that those features should be shaped by their sort of adaptive function. And those are sort of really interesting biological questions that we're going to be able to test as more work like this is done.
Interesting. Manvir, is there an evolutionary hypothesis to why some of these sounds develop for a particular function?
Yeah. So like Sam is mentioning, there are some people who hypothesize, for example, that music has evolved so that we can dance and we can kind of be a more socially cohesive group, or that we can dance together and signal to other people that we are a very formidable group. Alternatively, there are other evolutionary theories that say that lullabies, for example, the singing of lullabies and the listening of lullabies evolved for parents to signal their attention. So these are a body of theories that we call adaptive theories. They all say that music making and music listening evolved for adaptive reasons.
Interesting.
Then there are these more byproduct hypotheses that say that, yeah, actually the human mind has evolved and like our auditory capabilities have evolved for completely different reasons, and music has just kind of developed to really hack our psychology in a very gratifying way, kind of like a drug. And that's a byproduct hypothesis. Yeah. Our work can't really discriminate among them, but it at least does show that that the human mind does seem consistent across societies and how it responds to these different songs.
Now, I'm going to play one more group of songs. There was a type of song that people were not as good as identifying. Let's hear an example. Well, listeners, any idea what type of song that was? That was a love song, a Rwandan love song from Central Africa. It's a beautiful little song.
I love that recording.
Yeah, this is one of our favorites. Manvir and I are smiling and kind of moving around in the studio here.
Well, send us the rest of that one. Any theories on why love songs were so hard to identify for people?
Well, so we don't really know, but there are a few kind of interesting ways in which love songs could differ kind of categorically from the other songs that we studied in this paper. The first is just sort of a simple explanation, which is just that maybe across cultures, love songs are more ambiguously defined than something as kind of straightforward as a lullaby, where, you know, I think if you asked a lot of people on the internet, you know, what counts as a lullaby, people would kind of converge to things that are soothing for kids and babies and that kind of thing. But love songs are a little harder to define, so maybe the sort of ambiguous results just reflect that. I mean, it could also be that love songs are not defined so much, or are not obvious to listeners so much from their musical features, but are more obvious because of other things like the words that are in them. So there was a really interesting sort of secondary finding in our first experiment where we asked listeners how much they thought songs were used to tell a story. None of the songs in the data set were explicitly that kind of storytelling song, but even so, this measure seemed to pick up love songs. So love songs were highly rated as used to tell a story, which suggests that maybe there's something about the words of love songs that, you know, tell listeners, oh, this is more about love.
Mm-hmm. There has been some pushback to the study that in that these songs are all from small-scale societies and you played them for online listeners. Do you think this skews the interpretation? Is this just what internet users think of these songs?
Well, I mean, that's a really, really good point. Yeah, so all of our listeners are people who have access to the internet and people who speak English. So, I mean, one can make this response of, oh, so it might only be a very, very restricted population that shares these conceptions of what these songs should sound like. And we've taken that criticism seriously, and we are actually expanding our survey to 28 languages. So we're translating it, for example, into Indonesian and Urdu and Amharic. But then we're also taking it to the field. So we're taking it to, for example, Bolivia or Indonesia, and we have plans to take it to Vanuatu, and we want to play it for people who do not necessarily have access to this kind of globalized contemporary music culture, who will give us a better insight into whether these conceptions are shared by people who have little access
Does anybody have songs about the blues? Do we have common songs about everybody singing the blues?
Well, so we don't have any in the Natural History of Song discography yet, but one of the other things that we're doing sort of now that this paper's out is we're working on expanding the discography to cover more contexts of singing, and a pretty commonly found song type worldwide are laments, which is, you know, a fancier way to say the blues.
Yes.
Right? So yeah, it would be really cool to study those, you know, as we expand the data set.
Thinking of that song where first they rehearsed it and then nursed it. Okay, we'll have you back when we talk more about the blues. I want to thank both of you for taking time to talk with us. Samuel Mayer, Research Associate in the Department of Psychology at Music Lab at Harvard, and Member Singh, also at Harvard University. Thank you both for taking time.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having us.
You're welcome. And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, everything you ever wanted to know about jellyfish. I know you do want to know about them, the good, the bad, and the cool. They are really cool. We'll tell you why someone really wants you to know that. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. I never saw the jellyfish that stung me. I was snorkeling quietly, and then came the sharp pain in my shoulder and the welt that lasted a week. So when I now see a jellyfish, either as gooey blob washed up on the beach or swimming impulsively in an aquarium, I'm thinking, be careful. Yeah, there's still a bit of fear there in me. And I'm not alone. If you follow science news, maybe you've read the headlines like, the animal without a brain is taking over the oceans, or jellyfish are taking over the seas, and it might be too late to stop them. Needless to say, jellyfish are badly in need of some image repair. And my next guest, well, she's up to the challenge. In her new book, Spineless, science writer Julie Burwald has compiled some of the most fascinating and wonderful facts about jellyfish. Who knew? Like how it can launch its stinging cell with an acceleration of 5 million times the force of gravity. 5 million times the force of gravity makes the mantis shrimp look like a slow motion. And she explains why determining whether jellyfish are taking over the oceans is a lot more complicated than some of those dramatic headlines make it sound. In fact, it might not even matter. She joins me now, Julie Burwald, science writer and author of the new book, Spineless. Welcome to Science Friday.
It is a privilege to be here. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. Also joining us to discuss jellyfish science is Lucas Bratz, a postdoctoral researcher in the Institute for Oceans and Fisheries at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Bratz.
Thank you so much.
All right, Julie, tell us. I read the book's fascinating book. It is everything you ever wanted to know about jellyfish, but it's also your personal journey, is it not?
It is, yeah.
And
it is.
Tell us why you decided to share it with us.
You know, I really wanted to tell a story that where the author wasn't sort of this mystery person telling you really smart things all the time, and I felt like connecting with my audience was super important to me. It may be just because I like reading memoir and fiction a lot, but I wanted to make that connection with my reader.
But you also seem to want to debunk what we think about jellyfish.
Well, I wanted to add more nuance to the conversation, for sure. Yeah. You know, whenever you start looking at something hard, it's always more interesting than where you started before that. And when every time I dug into the story of jellyfish, you know, any part of them, I would find these gems, just these science stories I really felt like hadn't been told.
Yeah.
And it was so fascinating.
Do you think the media was misrepresenting what we knew about jellyfish, or what you were learning about jellyfish?
I mean, yeah, the headlines blare sometimes, and that's part of their job is to get people to read the article. And, you know, to tell you the truth, the science community is in a tough spot, because throughout the 20th century, the way we studied the oceans was by pulling nets and winches and using, you know, research vessels with big, strong motors to go through the oceans. And that was a really good thing to do, because the ocean is a very big place and we need to know more about it. But what happened along the way is we biased ourselves away from jellyfish, because the things that come up in those nets are durable, they're hard, they have bones or are shells or something like that to allow them to come up in those nets. So our understanding of jellyfish for the 20th century is really poor, and we can't get that back. So then when we started seeing larger blooms in coastal places, you know, it's easy to say they're taking over. But once you start digging into the science, again, like, the nuance is really, really important. Yeah. And I'm not saying they're not taking over, because in some places, there's definitely been a shift where jellyfish dominate ecosystems. But looking at those more local places might be the better way to go about it.
Lucas, I know you were part of a study that had scientists really divided over whether what jellyfish populations were doing, as Julie talks about, this kind of local. What was the debate over the data in that study?
Well, certainly there's a lot of challenges when you try to look at the population dynamics of something like a jellyfish. As Julie mentioned, they've historically been ignored. Both because of the sampling equipment that we use, but also because jellyfish populations naturally are highly variable based on the kind of life cycle that they have. So one year there'll be millions, the next year there'll be none, the next year it'll be thousands. So there's a lot of noise in the signal, and it's difficult to extract an increase. And so with this paucity of data around the world, at least scientifically, we had to start asking, well, should we include anecdotal data? You know, marine scientists or lifeguards or fishers who've been in an area for decades know it really well, and they can attest to say, yes, for sure, I've seen an increase in jellyfish in my lifetime. But a lot of scientists, you know, would reject that type of data if it's not, you know, categorical and yeah. data, you know, scientifically driven. So there's some controversy over whether or not you can include these types of anecdotal data.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask our listeners, do you think jellyfish get a bad rap? What have you always wanted to know about them? Our phone lines are open, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. What would you have to see then, Lucas, to be convinced that jellyfish are on the rise on the global scale? You say it happens in different places, and we know the oceans are warming, and there's new research showing that that's more hospitable to jellyfish populations. So what kind of data do you need?
Right. So, you know, when I'm asked this question, are jellyfish increasing globally, I often respond with, well, what do you mean by a jellyfish? What do you mean by an increase? What do you mean by global? And over what time frame? Because, you know, you can define those things in many different ways. There's no agreed upon definitions for a lot of those things. And so you can come up with different definitions that'll lead you to a yes, no, or a maybe. I think that the major conclusions we took away from our study was it's definitely not all jellyfish increasing in all places. But we did see a signal sort of around the globe that says jellyfish definitely appear to be increasing in more places than they're decreasing. And so we're seeing a lot of sort of sustained increases in different places around the world. And a lot of those places are very disparate from each other. So they don't appear to be sort of directly connected. And so, you know, we're seeing increases in jellyfish off the coast of Asia, around Europe, off the coast of Africa, even remote places like Hawaii and Antarctica. And so, you know, we start to question how many examples do we need before we can really say this is a global phenomenon.
But you know, I'm fascinated that you glossed over this quickly, but I have to back up. You originally said, what's the definition of a jellyfish? Are you saying we really don't have a clear definition of what a jellyfish is?
That's true. I mean, Julie covers this a bit in her book, and maybe she can speak to that. But, you know, these sort of gelatinous organisms that have certain characteristics, once we dig into the evolution and the taxonomy and the phylogeny of these types of different organisms, we realize that many of them are quite distantly related on an evolutionary timescale. So, you know, what we consider to be jellyfish might cover three different phyla. And so these distantly related organisms, lumping them into the same category can be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Julie, tell us why. Now let's go to the interesting good news about jellyfish. Why do you love them so much? What is so different? Tell us why we should love them as much as you do.
Yeah, so I mentioned that, you know, every time I sort of dug into a different element of jellyfish biology, I'd find these fascinating stories. And like one of my favorites was when I went to go visit these robotic jellyfish scientists in Woods Hole Oceanographic that were studying how jellyfish swim. And they were building robots to try to understand that. And what they learned was that, you know, that little peplum around the edge of the bell, the kind of floppy part that, just looks beautiful when they move. That is actually it doesn't need any muscles, but it drives the animal forward in the water. And the way it does it is by creating a low pressure system on top of the jellyfish. So a jellyfish actually sucks itself through the water rather than pushes itself through the water.
Mm-hmm.
And once they started looking around the animal kingdom, they found out everything has these, they call them passive margins, these floppy edges that goes through the water. And everything, the reason for that is just to suck, to use that pull to move forward.
You have to push someplace so you can move somewhere.
Yeah,
some sort of pushing someplace, but it's not there, is what you're saying.
There is pushing, but actually the pulling force is stronger than the pushing force. So anyway, it gave them this whole new perspective on how animals move. And it turns out jellyfish are the most efficient movers out there. They use the least amount of energy to go a certain distance for a certain weight.
Wow.
So, and then you mentioned the stinging cell, which is like this biological treasure. And it's one of the most sophisticated things I'd ever learned about. It explodes, as you said, at 5 million times the acceleration of gravity. And that's the fastest motion in the animal kingdom that anyone has ever discovered. Yeah.
That is amazing.
And it's even cooler, like the trigger. There's a trigger on that cell. And the trigger is a lot like the hair cells in our ears. So it's like a clump of cilia that can detect sound or vibrations. And the trigger has to both hear and smell its prey before it will deploy.
That is fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. Let me go to the phones because the people are now really, we got their interest. Jim in Houston. Houston, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. I was curious. I mean, I got stung when I was about 10 years old because I saw this gorgeous purple little thing in the water, a little pom-pom, and I picked it up, and as it slid through my fingers, it stung very much. But like the jellyfish that stung you, what can a jellyfish see or perceive, and with what sort of accuracy, and can it chase prey? And I was one time working in the Gulf, and I saw a Portuguese man-o-war as far as the eye could see. And it can kill a human being, but does it do it any good? If that jellyfish had killed you, could it have held on to you and consumed you? Or was it just, are stings just purely random?
Good question. Julie?
Okay, so lots of questions there.
Yeah.
Can they see?
Can they hear? How do they pursue their prey?
Yeah, so they have, you know, if you are in an aquarium and you're looking at a jellyfish, in between the scallops, sort of like, you know how the edge of the bell is scallop, there's a little sense organ called a rapalium, or rapalia in plural. And so they'll have like eight of them or more sometimes around the edge of the bell. And each one of those holds eye spots. It has a touch plate, which can feel the motion, the current of the water, and also smell, sort of detect chemicals in the water. And it has a balance sensor called like a staticist in there. So it's kind of like a little face, and they have many of them around the outside of the bell, and that is how they detect their environment to a large extent. Let's see, what other questions? Would they ever eat a human, Lucas?
That's definitely never been documented before.
You're just getting in their way, and they're just stinging you to get out of the way, or they're feeling threatened, I guess.
I mean, jellyfish do kill a lot of humans. It's hard to say how many, because the most dangerous jellyfish, the group of box jellies that can kill people that are located mostly in the South Pacific, are in a lot of countries where you don't have to file a death certificate. So it's hard to trace the records back. Of course, someone might just end up drowning as well. But, you know, a few estimates have put it at more than 40 per year, which, you know, is four or five times the amount of humans that are killed by sharks every year. So it's certainly significant. But, of course, in most of these cases, the jellyfish aren't actively hunting the humans. They're doing their own thing, and humans just happen to contact them and get stung by their tentacles.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking about jellyfish this hour. A lot of people want to know about it, but let me ask you, Julie, they eat algae, right? They
no,
what
most
do they
of them
eat?
Are,
plankton?
Yeah.
Plankton?
Yeah. Right. Most of them are carnivorous, so they eat
are.
Zooplankton. Yeah. They're after the zooplankton generally, or fish eggs. But you know, there was a guy who was studying jellyfish in Canada, and he's tried feeding them just different things out of his pantry, like oatmeal and peas, and they did eat them. So I think that even pine needles. So I think they will sometimes ingest things that, you know, maybe they're not so specific for, but then they'll spit them out. And then that's just one, that was a moon jelly. But then there's other studies that show that jellyfish will be selective. Other species will be selective and only go after a certain kind of zooplankton. So it's this kind of thing where when we group jellyfish into one big group, we're missing some of the complexity.
And Lucas, what kind of strategies have people developed for dealing with too many jellyfish in certain parts of the world?
There's been quite a few countermeasures that have been employed to deal with jellyfish populations. In terms of tourism, they have sort of stinger nets that they'll set up, and they'll basically clear an area of jellyfish and deploy these huge stinger nets. And Julie actually visited a town in Spain where they've spent quite a bit of money trying to do this. Other industries have dealt with jellyfish in various ways. You know, power plants that are affected by their intake pipes, they have different screens and bubble curtains and all kinds of things that they were trying, which aren't always effective. Certainly the aquaculture industry has been struggling with jellyfish blooms in recent years. You know, there's lots of sort of research going on in terms of how they can control jellyfish populations, in terms of, you know, using robots to kill them and drones to locate them and kill nets that they drag through the water. But none of them have been really that effective. I think really, you know, we're going to have a lot of difficulty controlling jellyfish populations. I think part of the immediate term research that we should be focusing on might be a better prediction model, where we can give people an early warning system that, hey, this might be a bad jellyfish month or jellyfish year. Keep on the lookout, instead of really, you know, spending too much money trying to control their populations.
We have a tweet coming in. It says, are there any health benefits from the parts of jellyfish?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk going on about that right now. Especially in Italy, there's a group studying nutraceutical, you know, effects, like what kind of value jellyfish have. And it looks like they could be involved in wound healing. When jellyfish, you know, they're often nipped at by fish, and when they heal, they don't actually scar.
Wow.
And there's some recent research showing that jellyfish can, tentacle extract, when it's applied to human cells, can actually stimulate cell growth and cell migration. So there's other evidence that jellyfish extract is super high in antioxidants, and some people have found some cancer-fighting abilities. So, yeah, that's a huge area of research.
Don't go away. Can you stay with us a few more minutes? We're going to take a break and come back, because we have so many questions from people who are interested in jellyfish. 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Talking with Julie Burwald, author of Spineless, great book if you want to know anything and everything about jellyfish. Also, Lucas Bratt. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're diving into the ocean of jellyfish facts. I'll put it that way. With my guests, Julie Burwald, science writer, author of the new book Spineless, Lucas Bratz of the Institute for Oceans and Fisheries at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We just have a few minutes left. I'm going to just cycle through a bunch of phone calls. People are asking all kinds of questions. Let them do the asking. I'm going to sit back a little bit. Maureen in Cape Cod. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. I enjoy your show very much. And I, too, was stung by a jellyfish that felt like an explosion, and it was a sea nettle. I have Parkinson's disease, and I have a tremor in my right arm, and I got stung by the jellyfish on my right shoulder. And it stung really badly for 24 hours. That entire 24-hour period, I did not have a tremor. My neurologist thought that was pretty interesting.
There you go. There's a line of research. Thanks for sharing it, Maureen. So it's sort of turned off her Parkinson's, or looks like it, for a little bit. Let's go to another phone call. Let's see if we can get as many in here. Let's go to James in Americus, Georgia. Hi, James.
Hey, Ira.
Hey there.
I have a question. Are jellyfish immortal? Like, can they go on living?
Wow, Julie, what's the life of a jellyfish?
So most jellyfish have a really cool and complex life cycle, and the egg and the sperm form a little larvae called a planula that settles and becomes a polyp. And then that polyp goes through this really amazing stage called strobilation, where it slices itself into like a stack of pancakes. And then each pancake bursts off the stack and becomes a little free swimming jellyfish called an ephyra, which matures into the medusa that you're probably familiar with. And there are a few species of jellyfish that are known to be able to go from the medusa backwards through their life cycle to the polyp stage, and then back forward again to the medusa and backwards to the polyps. So those jellyfish have been named the immortal jellyfish, and they are actually looking at them because not only does the animal go backwards, the cells in the animal go back to stem cells, which isn't something that we really know much about. And I mean, they've been able to do it in culture to take fully baked adult, you know, mature cells and go back to stem cells, but in animals it's very unknown, and so they're looking at that now to see how the jellyfish does it and what we might be able to learn from it.
Far out, as we used to say. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Matt in Wallingford, Connecticut. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Apologize for
go ahead
coming in. So I have two questions. One was how you just talked about the quote-unquote immortal jellyfish. So how is there any research so far in how that immortal jellyfish goes back, quote-unquote, in its developmental cycle and then forward again? Is that just the system stopping and then
starting
somehow going back
and
then doing something else? And also, the other question that I was wondering was, how do we differentiate between different jellyfish? Because just if, let's say, I go swimming and I see a jellyfish or something, how would I, as a casual observer, differentiate the different types of jellyfish? And as a scientist, if, let's say, you're trying to look at a specific, let's say, the quote-unquote immortal jellyfish, how are you supposed to figure out just by looking at it that, yeah, it is the immortal jellyfish and it's not some other type of jellyfish?
All right, let me get an answer. Lucas, can you tackle it? How do you know one jellyfish from the other?
Yeah, for sure. You know, there's thousands of species of jellyfish out there that have been identified, and probably tens of thousands more that we have yet to discover and identify. So it can be a challenge to identify the different ones. Obviously, some jellyfish look very different from each other in terms of size. You know, the giant jellyfish in Japan can get to be up to sort of say 500 pounds and 6 feet across, and then the immortal jellyfish that we've been talking about isn't much bigger than sort of your pinky fingernail. So there's certainly some jellyfish that look quite different than others. But once you get closer related between different species, it can be a challenge, but there are subtle differences that we use to identify one species from another. And then, of course, DNA barcoding as well. You can look at the genome of the different jellyfish, and that really gives you a clue to whether or not they're different species. Immortal jellyfish. Yeah, go ahead.
I am running out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you. One quick question for Julie. You still have a jellyfish tank in your house?
No, that wasn't very successful.
No.
It's kind of like having a carnival goldfish.
Didn't
make it too long. It's tough work, you know.
It's very
tough. You really have to have, a pretty big filtration system
before
you.
Saltwater aquariums are tough.
Yeah.
I used to have a little reef in my house. I understand. I get it. Julie Burwald, science writer and author of the new book Spineless. You can find an excerpt of her new book on our website, along with some beautiful photos, at sciencefriday.com/jellyfish. Lucas Bratz, postdoctoral researcher in the Institute for Oceans and Fisheries, University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Of course, you've heard that every snowflake is unique. Each one has its own special shape. That is true. But each flake is guaranteed to have six sides. You know those eight-sided snowflakes you see on holiday cards? Well, they might exist on a Hallmark store in a distant galaxy, but not here on Earth. And why is that? Well, the answer is crystals. Crystals, or crystalline structures, are not just in snowflakes. They're all around you. They're in diamonds and even chocolate. My next guest is all about crystals. He's a crystallographer, and he studies the chemistry of crystal structures. Jason Benedict, Associate Professor of Chemistry at the University of Buffalo in Buffalo, my alma mater. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here and to get to chat about the exciting science of crystals.
It is. Let's start with the basics, because I don't think everybody knows what a crystal is. What defines a crystal? Give us a simple definition.
Yeah, so one way to think about it is you have basically atoms or molecules that are going to arrange themselves in a repeating pattern. You know, the most simple case that everyone's probably pretty familiar with is something like salt or sodium chloride, where you have alternating layers of sodium atoms and then or sodium ions and chlorine ions, and these extend in three, you know, all three dimensions. It can get a little bit trickier there, but that's really the idea, is that it's a solid that's highly organized, and again, is sort of periodic or has a repeating structure.
And so snowflakes all have six sides. Let's put that to rest, right?
That's right. Now, they can have some pretty complex shapes, but the basic symmetry of a snowflake, at least a single crystal of a snowflake, needs to be sixfold.
Mm-hmm. And every now and then you hear of scientists trying to create a new form of ice, which is a crystal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something that's important to think about when you're discussing crystals, and that is certain molecules can actually adopt different crystal structures. And so this is known as polymorphism, where the same molecule again can organize itself into really pretty different ways, and this can actually have a pretty dramatic impact on properties. So this is important in things like pharmaceuticals. And really a variety of other things. But so how do you get crystals to do this? How do you get a substance to go into multiple crystal structures? Well, the two main parameters that people do are going to be temperature and pressure. So that is to say, if you apply an enormous amount of pressure, the molecules that are in the crystal will actually rearrange themselves to potentially form a new crystal structure. And so ice has a huge number of polymorphs that are generally accessed through, changing temperatures or changing pressures.
But when you press ice, don't you melt it? I mean, doesn't... How are you going to make a new crystal out of that?
That can happen. A lot of times we're talking about really pretty enormous pressures. Many times the atmospheric pressure to get into some of these phases. But it can also be triggered by temperature as well. So if you really cool ice down, this structure can change into a new crystal structure. And what's actually interesting about that is it doesn't necessarily need to have six-fold symmetry anymore. So you could actually wind up with crystals that don't have typical six sides.
Could have eight sides.
Sure.
So you're saying the natural form, it's only six, but when you fool around with it, you can make it eight.
Potentially. Now the trick there, the caveat would be that you have to grow the crystal under those conditions, and to get these spindly or dendritic structures of snowflakes, these are grown by crystals, having generally vapor phase, water molecules jump onto the crystal. It's a little trickier to do something like that, an experiment like that under ultra high pressure, but. I suppose in principle it would be possible, and you could get those eight-sided structures.
That's what you do, right? You look for ways to create novel crystal structures. You're a crystallographer.
Yeah.
So what's the useful stuff that comes out of what you do?
Yeah, so, the useful stuff, if we're just broadly, we can talk about some of the useful things that crystals, do. So they show up in all sorts of different technologies, computing, energy harvesting, chemical separations, and things like that. in chemistry, one very powerful aspect of crystals, and this is one reason that crystals are so near and dear to my heart, is that you can solve their structure. If you shine X-rays on it, and you know that's a whole another show, but we can use X-ray science to elucidate the structure, get the crystal structure, and if we know what the structure is, we can actually go back and figure out what the shape of the atoms or the molecules were that made that crystal. And so, for example, this is how people know the structure of DNA, right? People grew crystals of DNA, shined X-rays on it, and solved the structure. And so for a chemist, this is an incredibly powerful tool to figure out what you made.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Jason Benedict about crystal growing. Now, I said at the top that chocolate was a crystal. Did I make that up? Was that true?
No, that's absolutely true. And so getting back to what I had said about polymorphism, yeah, so the cocoa butter in chocolate can actually adopt a wide variety of crystal structures depending on what temperature the crystals grew. And so that's the whole science of chocolate tempering, is you want to grow just the right type of crystals in that chocolate to give it that characteristic snap and the shininess. So I do this stuff at home. It's one very nice and tasty applications of crystals. And
Do you make chocolate at home a special way because you know how to make crystals?
It certainly doesn't hurt. You know, I read up. I was like, hey. I forget exactly which polymorph it is, but that's exactly what chocolate tempering is trying to get all of the cocoa butter in that chocolate to adopt one single phase.
That's very delicious. Now, I know that you run the U.S. National Crystal Growing Competition, where students try to grow the best crystal. Tell us how that happens. Is it all about the temperature? What do you have to do to grow a good crystal? What makes a blue ribbon crystal?
Yeah, you know, it's on the face of it, it's pretty straightforward. But you know, if it was super easy, it wouldn't be much of a competition. So we grow a substance called alum, and again, this is provided by some of our generous sponsors that include the American Crystallographic Association and the NSF. And there's basically two rules to the contest. The kids start out with 100 grams of this material, and they have 5 weeks to grow the crystal. And so how do you turn basically 100 grams of powder into a big, giant crystal? You've probably seen some of the pictures online. Well, this is pretty easy. Anyone who's grown rock candy or something like that has really sort of done this before, except you want more careful control. The idea is you're going to toss this powder into water, heat it up, and let the water slowly evaporate. At some point, you're going to hit a point at which the substance needs to precipitate out a solution. In this case, it crystallizes out. And now there's some finer details in terms of growing a seed crystal and whatnot. But basically, that's all it is. You heat it up and let it cool. But there's a lot of stuff that can go wrong.
Especially when I do it.
Hey, well, give it a shot. Everyone should grow a crystal. I mean, that's why I do
that rock candy. And then when I was in school, everybody was growing rock candy on a string and a toothpick, you know, with the sugar water, that sort of thing. I know you had a cool crystal category. There was some glowing and purple crystals there.
Yeah, so this gets into the rules, right? I love, you know, seeing what people can do when you take away the rules and you just let people go. And that's what the idea was with the cool crystal contest. I just basically said, hey, grow a cool crystal. And you know, the only rule is when you send it in, I'm not going to be sending it back. And there was a teacher in a school district in Western New York who wound up taking a yellow highlighter and cracking it open and pouring the juice of the highlighter into the crystallization container. And out popped this crystal, and it's a colorless, perfectly colorless crystal. But if you shine the light on it, it glows this really nice sort of turquoise blue. And there's lots of pictures of it online on our Twitter feed and also on the crystal growing website.
Wow, and that's great stuff. I wish we had more time to talk about it. We actually have photos of some of the crystals from the United States Crystal Growing Competition up on our website at sciencefriday.com/crystal. Thank you, Jason, for taking time to be with us today. It's fascinating stuff. Good luck.
You're very welcome, Ira. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Jason Benedict, Associate Professor of Chemistry at the State University of New York, or they call it University at Buffalo in Buffalo, New York. One last thing before we go. Look up next week because there's going to be a total lunar eclipse on January 31st. Not only that, it's an eclipse of a blue moon, the second full moon of the month, and the eclipse is going to happen just 27 hours after the moon hits its closest orbital point to the Earth, called the perigee, meaning it'll be a supermoon. So you have a special super blue moon total eclipse trifecta in the early morning hours before sunrise next Wednesday, January 31st. Don't miss it. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and of course, we're on. So every day is now Science Friday because we have all our social community, and we're on Amazon Echo, on Google Home. You can tweet us and Instagram us and Facebook. You can also email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Every day now is Science Friday. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.